I hope that people are ready for the evening Dhamma discussion or talk. And I'd like to invite you to accept this teaching by saying sadhu.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
So we've been requested to discuss this Magandhya Sutta, and I thought maybe as a that I'd like to touch back over maybe one or two points that we've already gone over with this sutta, because I've been listening just like maybe the rest of the Dhamma audience, and I've been quite struck by a few points in the sutta that I thought maybe it would be nice for me to bring some perspective to it, a different perspective. And just through those sharing of different perspectives, maybe we can have a consilience or have a deepened overall perspective on what the Buddha is teaching in this sutta. And so in this sutta, the Buddha begins, it begins with a description of how this wanderer called Magandhya is, he comes to the clan house of the Bharadwaja clan, and he sees that something, a dais or an area has been prepared for the Buddha near the sacred fire pit that the clan would have had for their offerings, burnt offerings. And he asks who is it being prepared for, and he hears that it's being prepared for the master Gotama, and he immediately reacts to this, saying that the master Gotama is that the preparation for this bed or a bed of grass for the master Gotama is an ill sight. We see that the bed of that destroyer of when we see that the bed of that destroyer of growth, Master Gotama. And so this is quite a shocking expression that that this wanderer sort of attributes to the Buddha, that he is a destroyer of growth. And it's a very cryptic expression, this bhuna huno. And the commentaries mention that that this wanderer held a view that growth should be achieved in the six sense senses by experiencing whatever sense objects one has never experienced before without clinging to those that are already familiar. His view thus seems close to the contemporary attitude that the intensity and variety of experience is the ultimate good and should be pursued without inhibitions or restrictions. So many of you in the Dhamma audience today are enjoying a wealth of intensity and variety of experiences. You were maybe born in some village or town or city here in Sri Lanka and have, you know, migrated overseas and now settled in Perth, and have a great range of experience in life, both in intensity and in variety. And if you were to meet, you know, your old batchmates and friends from your time here in Sri Lanka, you would have a whole range of experiences in intensity and variety that you could, you know, share with your old friends and batchmates and family members here, and it would be radically different to their experience. And in this way, we can kind of develop an idea that more is better, and that this constant, you know, sort of acquisition of experiences and in all of the six sense doors is something to greatly seek after, that we should live here and now in this life, and that Nibbana is here and now, and to curtail the acquisition of these experiences is a great loss, is to live a very miserable sort of life. So this seems to be the crux of this wanderer Magandhya's, shall we say, aversion towards what the Buddha has to teach. I mean, this person is a serious spiritual wanderer, if we go through the, as we go through the sutta, we find that this person is very serious about his spiritual growth, and but he is quite convinced that that the way to achieve this spiritual growth is through the variety and intensity of experiences through the six sense doors, and any curtailment, any inhibitions, any disciplining of those six sense doors is a great detriment and loss to one's growth. It's in a way like saying, well, you know, if you're some sort of bumpkin and you live in a village, what would you know about the world? What can you know about your personal growth? You know, you've never grown up, you've never developed, you've never cultivated yourself. So it's a very critical point, you know, what is cultivation? What is bhavana? And how can we grow and mature in our spiritual lives? Is there a spiritual wealth even? And so this point was very striking to me because, you know, I led a reasonably successful life. You know, I was had the opportunity to attend a good secondary school, a good university. I was able to get a postgraduate education. I was able to, you know, get positions in companies and in management and so forth before I became a bhikkhu. And then when I became a bhikkhu, you know, some of my former colleagues or people that I, you know, family members and so forth would say, you know, what are you doing this for? Why do you wish to punish yourself? Why do you wish to cut yourself off from life? Why do you wish to, you know, curtail the intensity and variety of experiences that you can have in any of the six sense doors? So this was really quite a striking point to me. You know, I can sort of understand or empathize with this wanderer Magandia's perspective. And he's, but more than just a perspective, it's an ideology with the wanderer. It's really his belief, his firm belief and his understanding of the scriptures. So it's become a very hard ideology in this wanderer. So he is quite brash about this and says to the master Bharadwaja, even if we saw the master Gotama face to face, we would tell him to his face, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. What is that? Because that has come down in our discourse. You know, so it's very much against his ideology. And again, this point about how different ideologies shape how we see the world, experience the world, is again a very kind of current topic that's going on in the world, where my facts and your facts can be very different facts. A few years ago, I was teaching some children meditation in Ireland. And these kids were, you know, never exposed in their life to meditation, either in practice or in theory, I think, you know. They knew nothing about it. And they were kind of being pushed into it through Dhamma school by their parents. And I had about 30 children, and the eldest in the class was about 16 years old. And I, you know, managed to get all 30 children who were about between 8 and 16 years old, quite a range of ages and maturity, to settle down and become, you know, quite absorbed into their object of meditation. But one 16-year-old, the eldest person, a girl in the class, after about 15 minutes got extremely restless and just sort of gave an outburst in the middle of the class saying, "That's just your opinion." And it was quite out of the blue. But, you know, I was fortunately in a very calm state of mind and just sort of said, well, you know, if you're not enjoying this meditation class, you know, you're welcome to leave. You know, it's not compulsory. You don't have to be here. And something in this expression, this outburst of hers, began a very deep, long process. For about 5 years, I've thought a lot about what she had to say, that it's just your opinion. And I came across a useful expression, which is, you know, we all have our own opinions, but we sometimes don't have our own facts. But recently I came across, you know, where because of the way that the algorithms and, you know, the social media companies and so forth cluster information to people that, in fact, we're all becoming separate in our facts. So some people will think, for instance, a vaccination or a vaccine is a bad thing. And they will have a lot of facts in their mind around this. They will be quite persuaded and have an ideology as well as facts that support this, you know. And somebody else will have an ideology or a set of facts that will support not just their opinion, but also in a way their facts, their base of fact and truth. You know, what is the difference? That they will have a different perspective and on this and be quite keen to, you know, embrace a vaccine and a vaccination program, for instance. So these ideologies matter a lot. You know, what opinions we hold matter a lot. What facts we cultivate matter a lot. And the underlying ideology and thinking around our facts and opinions matter a lot. So it's very important that we consider what is my own, you know, ideology, what are my own opinions in general, and then what kind of, you know, facts and conclusions am I coming to in general, and to be quite careful about this and circumspect. So the Buddha has quite a difficult case in his hands to deal with, and it provides a very interesting study of how to deal with a person with a different maybe perspective than I would have myself, shall we say. So the Buddha he does this in a number of ways, but basically by being empathic and drawing Mahagandhya into his sort of circle. So he begins by asking to clarify with Mahagandhya what exactly is his ideology and underlying views. So he begins by stating what the Buddha's own view is first and saying, well, what do you think of this? So he begins by asking Mahagandhya, the eye delights in forms, takes delight in forms, rejoices in forms. That has been tamed by the Tathagata, guarded, protected, and restrained. And he teaches the Dhamma for its restraint. Was it with reference to this when you said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth? And Mahagandhya replies, it was with reference to this, Master Gotama, that I said, the recluse Gotama is a destroyer of growth. Why is that? Because that is recorded in our scriptures. So this is very important to understand. Mahagandhya is a person who is actually quite learned, as well as being a wanderer and a recluse himself. And his belief in his scriptures is very profound to him and has shaped his ideology very much. So he refutes what the Buddha has to say just on an ideological basis alone. And it drives Mahagandhya towards a very materialistic disposition, you know, where the intensity and variety of experiences through the six sense doors is of great importance. So we can see that the Buddha is diametrically opposite in teaching. He's polar opposite. So it's very interesting to see how the Buddha will draw in this very difficult mindset to come around to see the world from the point of view of the Buddha. So this is the beginning, but he has clarified immediately, look, this is your ideology and this is mine. Here are the poles. And now let's work towards a common understanding and find a way that's a middle ground on this. So Mahagandhya, he goes through a number of different scenarios. One is obviously with all six sense bases, which is, you know, one of the key teachings in the Buddha's teaching. There are many, many suttas that will discuss the six sense bases and how each, you know, how delight is arising at the eye door, the ear door, and ultimately at the mind door, and how we take delight and rejoice in these mind objects or eye objects or ear objects. And that if we are to tame our mind, we begin with guarding, protecting, and restraining the mind. And that this is the path. It's not a path of intensification and diversification of all of these objects. And if you look at the modern times, you know, this hedonic treadmill that people are on is very filled with this whole ideology that more is better. And, you know, more and more sort of hedonic pleasures, the sex, drugs and rock and roll of the world is the way to, you know, happiness. And that, like, for instance, in this COVID time where we have to have, you know, seclusion, social seclusion from these entertainment and eating out and so forth, this is a great, you know, considered to be a great disaster. It's not just economic disaster, but it's going to greatly damage our mental health. But actually, this is an ideology. It's an idea, and we need to verify it with facts. And we need to understand which people will be most affected by this, shall we say, lockdown situation, and who will maybe thrive in this lockdown situation. So I've been carefully asking a lot of meditators, young and old. We have a Dhamma school here, so we have children maybe as young as 5 years old who come to come here for teaching in meditation, in walking, sitting, standing, play, all sorts of activities. And we have, you know, their parents, and we have a whole range of meditators who come here. So it's been quite an interesting opportunity that I've had to, you know, interview people or just ask them, you know, how has coronavirus been for you in this time? Have you, you know, found this isolation, seclusion, this social distancing difficult? Has it been a burden, or has it been, you know, how has it been for you? And I must say, for people who know how to meditate, generally, are, you know, almost exclusively, they've all said it's been a great time. And, you know, if I ask them, well, what do you mean it's been a really great time? And they say, well, you know, there's less traffic, there's less noise, there's less busyness. I don't have to go to work. I can work from home. Or, you know, I'm spending more time with my family. You know, there is difficulties, you know, like wearing a mask, caution, going out shopping. But, you know, they explain it in terms of mindfulness, that it's brought to mind the day-to-day activities in a way. They have the training to mindfully move through life. So in a way, yes, it's a kind of a curtailment or a constriction, a contraction in what they can do. But it's also just been a creative constraint. You know, it's been something that they can work with, and then they can see how these things are impinging on their mind. And so I asked many of the children, you know, do you feel anxious? Do you feel lonely? Do you miss your friends? Do you miss your cousins? Do you miss playing? Do you miss that opportunity to, you know, just be a child and you know, play around? And I was quite surprised to hear that they weren't really feeling those losses and anxieties very much. And I said, well, what do you do? You know, how do you fill your time? How do you not become anxious, and how do you not suffer? And they said, well, I do walking meditation. You know, and this is from an 8-year-old, and I'm quite surprised, needless to say. And you know, well, what do you experience when you're walking? And so they said, well, you know, just walking. You know, and I say, well, what do you mean just walking? And they say, like, well, you know, just, you know, my foot is lifting and dropping, or my foot is lifting, you know, left foot, right foot. And, you know, I walk up and down outside of my house. And I, you know, so I ask them, what do you experience when you're walking? And they say, you know, they experience the air and the temperature. They experience the whether it's hot or cold, whether it's wet or whether it's dry. And I said to them, well, where is the anxiety? Where is the, you know, social isolation? Where are all these, you know, negative feelings? And they say, I don't have those feelings. You know, I just know that I'm walking. And I said to them, well, how come you can just know that you're walking? And they say, because I'm walking, I'm not thinking about other things. I know how to keep my mind on my feet, you know? I know how to keep my mind on my feet. And when I keep my mind on my feet, then I know all these other things, like that it's hot or it's cold. I know my condition. And so I know that I don't have this anxiety. I know that I'm not feeling alone. I know that I'm not missing my friends. I feel, you know, quite peaceful and happy and content. So whenever I wish to feel peaceful, happy and content, I just go for walking meditation, you know? And I personally find that very striking. It's a very interesting report to get from an 8-year-old child, because, you know, they're not trying to make it up. They haven't gotten cute yet to telling the teacher what they want to hear. And, you know, so some, I even ask their parents, do you understand this? Do you know how to do this? And in some cases, the parents don't know. So they're not learning this kind of attitude from their parents. They're learning it themselves from walking meditation. You know, it's not, they're not being told this by the teachers, and they're not being told this by the parents. They're being informed by their own experience directly, you know? And, you know, so it's sometimes very difficult when your life is pleasant and easy and not difficult to appreciate that there is an alter world, an alternative world where your life could be difficult and painful and in great discomfort. And so when we're having a good life, when we're having a good experience, when life is easy and beneficial, sometimes we don't appreciate that it could be very different, especially for a young child. And so, like, they don't really understand my questions when I say, like, where is the anxiety? Where is the fear? Where is the loneliness? You know, why are you not missing your friends? Why are you not missing playing around? Why are you not bored? Because they're happy in themselves. And so I really feel, you know, it's very encouraging to me as a kind of a teacher if I can teach children or be a part of their learning how to take care of themselves. They're, you know, giving them the tools that they can deal with what is actually a difficult situation, and for it to be, you know, just plain sailing for them, and for them to not even know that there could have, there was an alternative that, where their life could have been very difficult and difficult, is a wonderful gift, you know. And so if I ask them, you know, do you know that there are people, you know, children like you who are really suffering right now? And they're yeah, they kind of know, but they're not quite sure how that's working out for them. They just know their own life, their own experience. And so that's, it's a great blessing, you know, especially in such a young person to be given the tools like walking meditation that they can apply in, you know, skillfully in any circumstance, or even just specifically like I'm feeling bored, I'm feeling like restless, I need to do something and just get up and walk. And again, in my own development as a meditator, you know, I first had the idea that we had to have sitting meditation, and that meditating was sitting and just calming the mind and not being troubled by the mind. And of course, this is not how meditation really goes. So I had to really learn to accept and embrace that I had injuries in my legs and hips and back, and that sitting wasn't going to be an easy option for me. So I found walking meditation to be a great relief, you know. And so initially when I was walking or meditating at a meditation center, instead of following the normal schedule of 1 hour sitting, 1 hour walking, for instance, I would do maybe maximum 20 minutes of sitting And I would do, you know, maybe an hour and 40 minutes of walking, quite a lot of walking. So this was a great relief to me. And I achieved great benefit in walking. And I found that anyway, normally every day in life, you're going from A to B. And you could walk and do walking meditation as you were going from A to B. So it was a kind of a practice that I could practice all the time, whether I was at work or whether I was, you know, just out and about or I was at home. And it didn't, you know, of course, there's practice, but really practice is only the prelude for performance. So when we do walking meditation, just like you have the opportunity now in Jhana Grove, you know, you're surrounded with three walking areas, and then you have outside as a walking area too. You know, you're just practicing. The real performance is in your life as you walk through life. And every step you take, you know, have legs can walk. Well, if you can walk, you can meditate. And meditate meaning cultivate the mind and not be a destroyer of growth, but actually a cultivator of growth. And by restraining our faculties, restraining them from going here and there, and just giving the mind a meditation object of walking itself, we become very embodied into our current existence. So the more we know about our current state, the more we can ground our experience into our own reality and our own direct knowledge, then we don't have these gaps in our knowledge about what's happening in my life right now. So we have less and less opportunity for stories and narrative and ideology to just fill our mind. You know, like if people constantly say, well, aren't you anxious? Aren't you anxious? Aren't you anxious? If you're a good meditator, yeah, you know when you're anxious and you know when you're fearful, and you know when you're not anxious and you know when you're not fearful. And that can be a great relief. You know, you can identify clearly in your mind things that cause me to feel fearful, places and situations that I find fearful. So you can make wise decisions around, you know, your activity and interest in that time. So, for instance, if, you know, listening to a lot of news, for instance, causes fear and anxiety to arise in your mind, well, maybe you don't need to be so well informed by the news outlets and media. Maybe if you follow social media, maybe it's a useful tool for you for keeping connection with your family overseas or around the world. But beyond that, it might not be that useful. So we can understand what our limits and constraints are, and we can take the appropriate steps that are suitable for my own individual case. And this is coming in from the practice leading into the performance of life. You know, the meditation is about bhavana. Bhavana is growth, is cultivation, you know, and this is how we can really know our own opinions, our own ideologies, our own facts. And when we meet people who have different opinions and different facts and different ideologies, you know, we can be circumspect. We can reflect, oh, okay, you know, I can see that I have different ideologies and facts and opinions to this person, and I can see that from the best of my own understanding that my own opinions and facts are grounded in my own direct experience, and that I don't know about these other aspects of life, and that's okay. You know, I can be content with what I do know. I can be content with my own experience, my own reality in the world. And if I can see that my reality is in line with the norms of society and in line with, you know, wise friends, my Kalyana Mitta, sort of sensible people that I hopefully cultivate around me in my life, or I can, you know, if I know somebody in particular that I have a lot of trust in, and I can ask you know, well, I have this opinion, I have these facts, what do you think? And if they too hold, yes, those are similar facts to what I understand the world to be, and, you know, I understand your opinion about it, then we can sort of understand that maybe there are people who have facts and opinions that are not in accordance with my own reality, and I can try in, at some level to just keep away from that. You know, I can, otherwise it will be just maybe a lot of friction and a lot of burden in my life. So I find this ability to cultivate my own knowledge internally in my heart and develop a maturity and an experience that is internal, introspective, is of great benefit. So that when, you know, I approach suttas like this sutta at hand today, I can go, aha, there you go, there it is. There it is written down. I wasn't crazy all this time. You know, where I don't have to be like an experience vulture, you know, just trying to acquire as much intensity and experience in the world. I don't have to be going here and there. I don't have to know every item of news on the hour, every hour. I don't have to, you know, have had the bucket list or whatever it is that's the current fashion. I don't need the latest this or that. You know, that in fact, I'm not crazy. I'm okay. I'm peaceful, I'm calm, I'm content, and I'm serene. And these are very nice qualities of mind to cultivate and develop and be rich in, that I have a different values around what is rich for me. It may not be in terms of material possessions or, you know, I live in this area or this postal code, you know, I have this kind of car, I have this kind of gadget. You know, it doesn't, maybe that doesn't do much for me anymore, because those things would be a burden. I see the fault or the flaw in those things. And this is my reality, you know, and I don't need other people to, I don't need to be keeping up with the Joneses to feel okay in my reality. I don't need to take the weather from other people. I don't need other people's opinions on how I live my life, or especially my own inner critic. The inner dialogue running in my mind, I can hear that voice and I can, you know, question its rationale and question its ideology and, you know, in a kind and caring and compassionate way. And I can retrain my mind to not be over anxious or not to be neurotic or not to be depressed about my expectations and my opinions. And all of it comes back to this ability to, you know, cultivate my own knowledge and information through the six sense doors. And that is incredibly liberating, that the problem and the solution is within the fathom of our own body. And that's why, you know, this ideology of Mahagandhya is so troublesome, because it requires external conditions to be just right. And, you know, when the Buddha later on describes, you know, his own development as a princeling who was in great wealth and in great abundance and great material prosperity, and how his father had constructed a life of great ease so that he wouldn't be such driven into the spiritual world to seek pleasure there, that the material world would provide all of those wealth or pleasures or be an ultimate goal or that... You know, that's external, because as the Buddha points out, there's flaws like you could be sick, there's flaws like you could be aging, there's flaws like you could be dying. And he mentions then in specific leprosy and how for relief a leper might be cauterizing his wounds on a fire so that the medicine was rough and painful, but you know, maybe that would be a relief to a leper. But later on, if that leper was cured, well, he wouldn't continue that medicine of cauterizing his flesh on hot burning coals, because that would be very, very painful. And so when we are overly reliant on the externalities of the world, the vagaries of the world, then we are subject to great suffering. So like in this present time where so many things we took for granted, you know, being able to jump on an airplane and fly around, not need vaccinations before we travel, not need medical biopasses, you know, just our passport was enough. Now we, in future, I think we'll need a biopassport. And, you know, we had, you know, this supply chain of goods. We could just have anything, you know, at our beck and command if we had enough wealth. You know, whereas now, even if you have a lot of wealth, well, you're still restricted in what you can get or where you can go or what you can do. And, you know, who knew? Who knew that the world was such a chaotic and unreliable place? And, you know, so this pointing of the Buddha towards, you know, that this curtailment and restriction in our six sense bases and our six sense doors, and this curtailment in the intensity and variety of experiences that we can have in the world, and this cultivation or bhavana of mental objects, who knew that that would be the way out? You know, that's not what you find on the marketing and on the signboards and on the bus stops and all these other places that you know, we have signage saying to us, this is the way towards happiness. You know, more is better. Who knew? Who knew that you can live a very simple, peaceful, content life, and that would be the escape from suffering? So it's quite a radical teaching that's going on here. So the Buddha goes through and he says, why is it, Mahagandhya, a delight apart from sensual pleasures, apart from wholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss, is possible in this kind of practice of meditation? Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior, nor do I delight therein. So who knew that you can actually find higher pleasures, pleasures that are superior, pleasures that are not unwholesome, that are in fact entirely wholesome, in the restriction of your faculties? So when the teachers ask you to, you know, not engage in chit-chat and, you know, to act modestly, to behave modestly, you know, it's not because we're prison guards and we want to torture you. It's because this curtailment of the faculties is the essence of liberation. Because what we give up an inferior pleasure for a superior pleasure. I mean, it's really a wonderful thing that we have this Visuddhimagga, this path of purification, where we go from coarse to more and more refinement as we, you know, develop. And the refinement is ultimately on this, you know, mental experience of the world, this internal experience, this introspection. So who knew that such a thing was possible? But yet we can know for ourselves directly through the practice itself. Through practice and ultimately through performance. So even when we compare ourselves to a king, have you ever seen or heard of a king or a king's minister enjoying himself, provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, without removing the fever from sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst, with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able, or who will be able to so abide? No, Master Gautama, says Mahagandhya. So we ask you to put aside these pleasures that all of you enjoy. It's a reasonably comfortable and pleasurable life in Perth. At least there isn't this rampant coronavirus at the moment, and there isn't extremities of the weather, at least. As far as I know, there aren't fires burning at the moment around Perth at the moment, as far as I know. I could be wrong. So we have this bountiful place in the world at the moment, a wonderful existence to some degree. So we are like that king or the king's minister enjoying oneself, provided and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure. Yet, you know, it is with a mind inwardly at peace that we need to cultivate and abide in. And eventually this is what brings Mahagandhya around. I too have never seen or heard of a king or a king's minister enjoying himself provided with or endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasure, without removing fever from sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able or who will be able to so abide. On the contrary, Mahagandhya, those recluses or Brahmins who abide or abided or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, all do so after having understood, as they really are, the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. It is after abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and removing fever for sensual pleasures that they abide or abided or will abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. And the Buddha emphasized this point by saying, the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The Eightfold Noble Path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless. So it depends on our goal. If we have a lofty goal, a great goal, like to be free from, you know, to be free from death and have the safety of this freedom from death, as death is a great suffering. Going from life to life is a great suffering. You know, the vagaries of the world, the vagaries of this life and the next life. This life is a good life. I'm enjoying the bounties of a materially successful life in Perth. So, and I have a nice family, I have great conditions, I have all these five chords of sense pleasures. But the next life is uncertain. It's uncertain. So yes, it is a great gain to have good health. But ultimately, it is this extinguishment of suffering, this end of suffering, that is the greatest bliss. So physical health is a great blessing, but it's this mental quality of freedom from suffering that is the ultimate bliss. And the Eightfold Noble Path is the best of paths. You know, we might know how to prosper in the material world. We might know how to prosper in the academic world or in the sports world. But this path of the Eightfold Noble Path is the best of paths, because it leads to the safety, this safety, rakita, of the deathless, you know, because it is this rebirth process that is the problem. So even Mahagandhya could accord with some of this verse. He said that the greatest of all gains is health and Nibbana is the greatest bliss. This was a teaching that the wanderers themselves had known, because it had been from previous Buddhas and kept in their scriptures. But the other part of the teaching had been lost. The part of the Eightfold Noble Path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless. So it's interesting how these fragments of prior Buddhas come down, but the key essence is lost, the essence of the Noble Eightfold Path and these teachings around the mechanisms of rebirth, particularly the role of intention and the means to escape, like Vipassana meditation. So this is what really brings the Mahagandhya to the Buddha, is where they can agree on things. They can agree on a common ground. They can establish mutual facts and align certain opinions that they might have about things. And this begins this great change in Mahagandhya, where he begins to actively and take on the teaching from the Buddha. But he further asks Mahagandhya, have you heard, you know, what is health for you? And so Mahagandhya rubs his own body and says, this is health, Master Gotama. This is Nibbana. I am now healthy and happy and nothing afflicts me. But it's a deep irony that Mahagandhya is in a good state of condition, like, you know, to some degree, like living in Perth at the moment is a good state. It's a good condition. I'm in good health. All's great. You know, there is no problem. But the problem really is that it's intrinsic to our existence. You know, just like with the children who know how to meditate, they don't know the diseases that they're protected from. Or if somebody maybe takes a vaccination, they don't realize the suffering of what it is to get the illness. And you know, so it's a great benefit to have a vaccination, and the Dhamma is the greatest of all vaccinations to take. So just because I'm happy here and now, just because I'm in good health here and now, doesn't mean that I will not age and that I will not die. There is still these great sufferings awaiting for me. And as long as I take rebirth, you know, and I'm subject to the vagaries of my past karma, you know, I will go from a good life to a bad life, faring according to my karma. And it's not that possible to stop the ripening of bad past karma, as, you know, Mahamoggallana, for instance, was, even as a great arahant, was beaten to death, basically. And, you know, so it's not possible to avoid our past karma, as, you know, even the Buddha had back pains and so forth. Just because you become an evolved person, an enlightened person, doesn't mean that you're escaping the suffering of aging and sickness and death, but you are escaping the suffering of rebirth into that process again. So this, the greatest of all gains is health, and Nibbana is the greatest bliss. Yes, that's only one part of it, but you know, to really escape the rounds of rebirth requires us to thread the Noble Eightfold Path, and it is the best of paths, for it leads to our ultimate safety and to escape from death itself. So I would really encourage you to, you know, embrace walking meditation as a way of traversing that Eightfold Noble Path. If you can practice your walking meditation in the conditions provided in Jhana Grove, then this will be a great basis for your performance in daily life. And every step you take after the retreat can be a further step down the road of the Eightfold Noble Path, as long as you're just practicing mindfully, you know. So when you're practicing, you know, moving left foot, right foot, and then as your meditation or your attention or your awareness is cultivating and developing on that movement of the foot, then you can start to notice lifting and dropping, lifting and dropping. And then as your attention and awareness develops and cultivates further, you can notice lift, push, drop. And this is quite a refined level of knowledge about the movement of the feet. And then associated information can just automatically come to the mind. Like at a certain phase, in the lifting phase, for instance, the foot can feel light. And there can be a slight thrill as the foot moves forward. And there's a heavier sensation as the foot is dropping. So we start to become intimate with these ideas of elements, that there are the four elements. You know, like you have Vayodhatu, wind element, Vata, as it's called in Sinhalese. And then you have the heat element, Pitta. And you have like that these wind elements have this quality of movement, stiffness, hardness. Then you have different qualities like heaviness, lightness. So with Pitta, with heat comes lightness. But then also the earth element, the hardness, the coarseness of the ground, the impact of the feet on the ground. So that we understand hardness and we understand heaviness and so forth. So we start to become very intimate with the elements. And then, of course, there's the water element as well, which is not directly experienced, but indirectly comes together from cohesion and a sense of, like, for instance, sweat moving across the body. There's a cohesive, a sticky quality to it and a lubricating quality to it. And so we become intimate with these elements in our body and in our movement and our motion and as we walk and in the hardness of the ground and the hot and cold temperature conditions of the air, the dryness in the air. If it's very dry, there's a lack of cohesion. If it's moist, it's more cohesive. So we can start to understand when, like, if you know Ayurvedic medicine, then they start to talk about balancing the elements in one's diet and in one's life. You know, I'm quite surprised sometimes when I meet Sri Lankans that they don't really understand their own Ayurvedic medicines because they don't really understand the elements. They have no direct touch. But through the walking meditation, the elements are much more pronounced and obvious compared to sitting meditation, for instance. And compared to just ordinary daily life, most people have no idea of these elements and how they're being active in every aspect of our life almost. And it becomes a great insight. Oh, so these are what the doctors are, you know, pointing us towards. So we can have that physical health where the greatest of all gains is health. So we can be moderate and we can adjust accordingly our food, our exercise and all kinds of aspects of our physical well-being because we have this touch, direct touch with the elements that are active in our own body and then within our own environment and within our own food. So as the Buddha said again, kama, citta, utu, ahara. So once we understand these factors, we have a lot of gain over our own health. So walking meditation is a direct pathway into this wonderful world of good health. We can have a longevity. We can have a good stamina. We can balance the elements in our body, meaning not too heavy, not too light, not too dull, not too sleepy, and bring energy into our practice by walking. And achieve a great benefit in our welfare and happiness. So it's not about, live a miserable life now and heaven will be the great reward, but we can actually enjoy great benefits here and now through the gain of the Eightfold Noble Path itself. These are physical benefits as well as mental and spiritual benefits. So as a result of this kind of dispensation from the Buddha himself, then Mahagandhya, Master Gautama is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can come to know health and to see Nibbana. So Mahagandhya, suppose there was a man born and born blind and could not see dark and light forms, the sun and the moon. Then his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives would bring him to a physician to treat him. The physician would make a medicine for him, yet by means of that medicine, the man's vision would not arise or be purified. What would you think, Mahagandhya? Would that doctor reap weariness and disappointment? Yes, Master Gautama. So too, Mahagandhya, if I were to teach you the Dhamma thus, this is that health, this is that Nibbana. You might not know health or see Nibbana, and that would be wearisome and troublesome for me. So what we've been teaching today has been also not just about your present moment welfare and happiness, but your future happiness. And, you know, this reference particularly to the Eightfold Noble Path and its goal and destination of leading us out of the deathless, not just the physical welfare here and now, is a very profound aspect of all of the teaching of the Buddha. So I hope that we've covered some of these points today, and the rest of the sutta, I think, will be in the capable hands of Venerable Dhammajiva again to guide you. So maybe we can start to close the talk and share the merits.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.